That's the picture of the high school my sons attended. Sometimes I would need to go home during the day back to my house, and the road between my office and my house would take me right past the high school. And as I would drive by, I would glance over and I would wonder what was going on with my kids that day. Sometimes, Jeff, when I was a little darker, I would wonder what struggles they might be engaged in that day. I can imagine in my mind, maybe they were sitting an algebra test, struggling with the test, because they are my children, and math problems, I think, are genetically wired. But anyway, I can imagine them struggling with this algebra test and maybe tempted to look over to that smart girl in class and see what she had written down. Or maybe they're sitting at a lunch table and there's a conversation going on that is increasingly getting uncomfortable, and they know they really shouldn't be part of that, and they're trying to muster the courage to get up and step away. Or maybe it's science class and the teacher's going on building the mountain of evidence for evolution, and they're wondering to themselves, should I speak up? Should I say something, or should I keep quiet? I wondered on that day where the battle might be for them. You ever wonder that about your kids? Maybe not when you're driving past the school they attend, but maybe as they take their device and walk back to their bedroom and close the door, or maybe it's as they head out the door on a Friday night to go out with a crowd of friends. Maybe a crowd of friends you don't know all that well, and as they leave, you kind of have that dark moment too, and you're wondering in your heart, where is the struggle for them? What battles might they have to face? You ever wonder about that? I had a group of kids together one Sunday night for a devotion many years ago. We were talking about heaven. And after talking about that, as we got to the very end, I posed this question to them. I said, if you should miss heaven when all of this is over, what would the reason be? Or to ask that another way, if you wind up not getting to heaven, what would the obstacle be that got in your way? Or what do you see as the biggest challenge you face that's inhibiting the journey ending up where you wanted to? I posed that question to them. I gave them all a little white index card, and I said, you can write your answer down anonymously. Think about that and write your answer. And so they wrote their answers and turned them in, and I just read through the cards, and we talked about what they had said. I was so impressed that when we got done, I said, do y'all mind if I share this? I won't say who was who, because I didn't know. But I think moms and dads and brothers and sisters in Christ and church families need to know, from your perspective, where is the battle? Where are you struggling? And so they said yes, and now you know where I'm going with my sermon. I'm going to share what they shared with you this morning, and I want you to know I have their permission, so I'm not violating any policies of confidentiality with them. But I want you to know what a group of teenagers gathered on a Sunday night had to say about where the struggle is for them. To the end that maybe as moms and dads and brothers and sisters in church family, we can help them wage the battle. So, for this to be memorable, I've boiled it down to four words that I'd like you to carry away this morning. So let's begin. The first word that I want you to carry away with you this morning is the word lust. Because that appeared on several cards in some form. The kids said, if I don't make it to heaven, some of them said, it will be because I caved to my lust. Lord talked about that. If you'll make your way to the Sermon on the Mount, we'll hit that a couple of times this morning. Matthew chapter 5, that comes to my mind. Matthew 5 and 27, where the Lord said, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And so already the Lord has talked about this, and he has defined holiness for us, if you will, with regard to our lust. We've got to rein them in. We've got to control them. And yet what this kid is saying is not just I know what the Lord wants. What he's saying is I am struggling to do what the Lord wants. Anybody surprised by that? I mean, folks, we live in a culture that is not helpful with this. It is a sexually charged culture where all around us there are opportunities to look with lust. And maybe when I say that, your mind immediately jumps to the internet and smartphones and the instant access that gives to all kinds of illicit images. And that is certainly a problem. It's just not limited to that. My goodness, a young man can't walk down the halls of school or through the mall without seeing something he doesn't need to see. My boys and I remember, we were standing in line at Starbucks one time, and there was a young lady who was so terribly immodest in her dress that it caught the attention of all of us. And we just kind of stood there in line and looked around at other places. And I remember we got done. We walked out into the parking lot. The three of us, as we walked out, one of them said, the green shorts, and the other one said, yeah, it was bad. I mean, you can't even stand in line at Starbucks and get a cup of coffee. It's everywhere. And what at least one person who attended this Devo was saying is, this is where the battle is for me. I am struggling. I may not make it to heaven because I'm losing the struggle with my lust. So, if we are concerned about that, we need to stand shoulder to shoulder with our kids and help them push back this assault that the devil is making on them. Now, I tell you, for some parents, that means that we're going to have some uncomfortable conversations with our kids. It is surprising to me that in this day and age that there are still some parents who are uncomfortable talking to their kids about sexual purity. I remember talking to a mom a few years ago who said, you know, I just don't want to talk to my teenage son about that because I don't want to rob him of his innocence. And I had to really gently try to tell her that she was naive about that. That the culture is way ahead of her on this. And they don't give us the opportunity to be silent about it. Got to talk to our kids about this, folks. And Scripture, frankly, has a lot to say that our kids need to hear. It needs to begin at the beginning. In Genesis chapter 1, we need to explain to our kids that these desires and passions that they feel are God-given desires. I love verse 27 of Genesis 1, where God looks at everything that he made and said, this is all good. And he was talking about our sexual desires too. And he said that kids need to get that. And then maybe we need to hop over to the Song of Solomon and take this magnificent book that talks about the beauty of romantic sexual love in the right place. It celebrates it there and emphasizes in the right place, because it at least three times in the book, like in chapter 2 and verse 7, it warns that we don't awaken love until she pleases. There's a right time for this. It is utterly bizarre to me in this day when everyone is talking about sex, the one book of the Bible really devoted to that subject is the one we almost know nothing about. And we certainly don't think about teaching it to kids. I mentioned that one time. I said, we need to teach the Song of Solomon to the high school class. I think three people fainted. We do. They need to learn that sex in the right place as God intended is a wonderful thing. And then they need the warnings too. That's important. We encountered that in our journey through Hebrews at the end of last year. There at the end of Hebrews in chapter 13 and 4, the marriage bed is to be undefiled. And that powerful warning, fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. Kids need to do that. Kids need to know that in this day and age, fornication is a sin. We teach them that. And more than that, you need to get them over to the works of the flesh in Galatians 5 and verse 19. And the warning there about sexual sin, just the bigger warning, where it talks about impurity and sensuality and begins to take in not just what we do, but how we think and what we say and about our discipline and controlling ourselves. All of that is stuff that our kids need. And we've got all kinds of Bible stories that we can plug in along the way. The David and Bathsheba story. 2 Samuel 11 has some wonderful lessons about just how much you can mess up your life when you get off the path and stop doing what the Lord wants you to do. There's a lot in the Bible about this, folks. And young people are struggling here. And so we need to help them with this struggle. Because at least one person in my Devo said, if I don't make it to heaven, the most likely reason will be because I caved to my lust. So will you carry that home word home with you and think about it? Our kids are in a battle with their lusts. Now, let me give you a second word I'd like you to think about. This one's going to be a little bit different. Second word I'd like you to carry today, away today is the word light. And you're thinking, boy, those two things do not seem to be related to each other. Well, it was a group of teenagers, and the answers weren't necessarily all related to each other. And this one was completely different from the first one. I had at least two people in my Devo, two teenagers who said, if I don't make it to heaven, it will be because I was hiding my light. I was intrigued by that. Two of them said that. And maybe, again, your mind goes to the Sermon on the Mount, and it should go there because clearly that's what they were thinking about in Matthew 5, going down to verse number 14. After describing the character of kingdom dwellers, Jesus picks up and says, you are the light of the world. I think these kids were thinking about that. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. And that verse seems especially to have been resonating in their heart. They're putting their light under a basket. When Jesus said, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. I think they had a sense of their responsibility to shine as lights and tag that to the end of Matthew's gospel in chapter 28 and verse 19, to go make disciples of all the nation. I think they were feeling that sense of responsibility in a dark world to be a light and help other people find Jesus. What seemed to be troubling the people who shared this answer, though, is they weren't shining. I mean, it's a beautiful figure, isn't it? I love disciples being described as this bright light shining in a dark world like a city set up on a hill. It is a beautiful figure. It is hard to execute. When it calls us to be different from our culture, to be holy when surrounded by an unholy word, that world, that is tough, and it carries consequences because sometimes it means the crowd moves on without me and leaves me out and maybe even alienates me and ridicules me. And so what I loved about this answer is this young person was really being honest and saying, I struggle there. I know that I need to be a light, but I'm looking a lot more like verse 15 sometimes. I'm covering it up and hiding who I am. And so, if we want our kids to go to heaven, be a bright, shining light in their world, we need to stand shoulder to shoulder with them and help them wage this struggle. Hey, parents are critical to this. I think moms and dads blaze the trail in this regard. We need to set the example by being a light in our world, being courageous and being willing to share our faith with other people and being willing to take some heat for that. I think when our kids see that in us, it helps them find their own courage to do the same. I think when we think about reaching our world, we need to include our kids in that thought as well. You know, folks, evangelism is a duty for every disciple. God did not say, go teach the gospel to every creature after you turn 18, or when you finish college, or after you get married and begin a family. Then you sort of get church adult responsibilities. Scripture doesn't ever say that. If I'm a disciple, whatever my age is, I have a responsibility to people around me. In fact, I'll just be honest. Over years I've been preaching, I have found that young people are the best soul winners. No problem at all getting out and talking to their friends, inviting them to come, having Bible studies with them. It's some of the best workers that I've known. And so as we think about that work, we need to think about our youth. Our kids need to be included in our training. They need to be prepped for this work. As a church, we need to encourage our kids to get involved in it. And imagine the powerful blessing that comes from that. Kids who grow up being expected to reach their friends. We could change the next generation of the church if we would do that. Kids are just wired to do evangelism because it's what they've always done. They're struggling here, folks. They're struggling to shine as lights. We need to help them do that. So, the second word I wanted you to carry away today is the word light. We need to help our kids shine as light. Then there's a third word I want you to carry away today. The third word I want you to carry away today is prayers. And I know that one looks strange too, doesn't it? Weren't expecting that. I wasn't either. I had at least one of these teenagers in my Devo say to me, if I don't make it to heaven, it will be because I didn't pray. I didn't expect that. It did tell me some things about whoever wrote that answer down. It told me that they recognize not just the need to go through a spiritual ritual, but it said something to me about the value they attached to prayer, that they saw it, I think, as it should be seen, as this vital component to a rich and deep spiritual life. It is, after all, brothers and sisters, half of the communication lifeline we have with God, isn't it? We have his book open this morning. We're looking at what he says to us. That's how God speaks to us. And then the other half of that lifeline is we pour out our hearts to God when we speak to him through prayer. It is vital. And I think this very young person really had a sense of that, how important it was for them to pray rich and full and meaningful prayers. And I think they saw something else. They weren't there. They were struggling with it. The Lord paves the way for us on this. If you'll jump ahead in our Bible reading, we're going to be reading Luke chapter 5 here in another week or so. Notice this in Luke 5 and verse 15, because you find this all over the gospel record. In Luke 5 and verse 15, the text says, but the news about him was spreading even farther, and large crowds were gathering to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses. So Jesus is growing in his popularity. The crowds are getting busier. There's more demands on his time. But then verse 16 adds this, but Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray. Hunter did a magnificent job with us last summer preaching about the prayer life of Jesus. Do you remember that? And he showed us several other examples, like the one here in Luke 5, where the Holy Spirit felt the need to talk to us about how Jesus prayed. And then the Spirit, through Paul, would come along later in that letter through the Thessalonians and tell us to pray without ceasing, pray all the time. That admonition is over and over and over again in the text. And yet, we know, don't we, that with our busy, hectic lives, we get caught up in that stuff and find it difficult to pause and to make quiet time to commune with the Lord and pray, right? Here's the thing I want you to see this morning. Our kids are there too. They're struggling with that. And so if we want our children to have a rich and full and meaningful relationship with the Lord, where their hearts are in His words and directed to Him, if we want them to have a meaningful prayer life, we need to stand shoulder to shoulder with them and help them with this. I gotta tell you, I wonder sometime if that even dawns on us. I fear that at times we view prayer as just sort of this innate thing that everybody knows how to do, like eat spaghetti. Everybody knows how to do that. Kids know how to pray. I don't need to teach my kids how to pray. And yet in Luke 11 and verse 1, the disciples of Jesus come to Him and they say, teach us how to do this. Isn't that interesting? I don't think it's innate, praying well. I do think prayer is a learned activity. So it's part of that obligation in Ephesians 6 and 4 to bring up our children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Surely at least a piece of that is teaching kids how to pray in a way that is rich and full and meaningful. And so don't assume they're just going to get it and figure it out. They're not. They're struggling. We need to teach them how to pray. I got a couple of suggestions about that. Bible prayers themselves are a great resource. For example, in Nehemiah chapter 1, most of the first chapter of the book of Nehemiah is a prayer that Nehemiah offers up to God. And it's rich and full with illustrations for us to talk about what kinds of things you say when you pray. Yes, he asked God for something there, but that's actually one little thing at the end. That prayer is full of praise and adoration for who God is and what God has done and will do. And it's full of confession and acknowledgement of his failure and the nation's failure. You go back, you look at that prayer, there's all kinds of things to teach kids about what to put into their prayers. And actually, there are lots of Bible prayers like that that are a great resource for that kind of teaching. We need to talk to our kids about how to address God. That doesn't have to be this formal thing like you're making a speech before Congress, but you can have a conversation with God like he's a good friend. I don't like the way I said that, like he's a good friend. Because he is a good friend. Isn't that how we want our kids to see him? And praying together is another vital piece of that. I think one of the most valuable things families can do is to find a way to pause at the end of the day when you guys can be in the same place at the same time. For us, it was in our oldest son's bedroom around 9 o'clock when it was time for them to be headed to bed. And we just paused and prayed together. Let your kids hear you pray. And what you say. Just praying together is instructive. Take the time, though, every day, to pause and spend that quiet time doing that. Now, maybe already you kind of sense the elephant in the room when we talk about that. And the elephant in the room is, if I want my kids to have a rich, meaningful habit of prayer, yeah, I need to have that too. So maybe one of the reasons it's really hard to talk to our kids about this, because it's not just them struggling to carve out time and make this a priority. I'm struggling with it too. And so here's the good news. Maybe rather than just lamenting the fact that none of us are very good at this, what we're going to do is we're going to get really good together as a family, right? Because our kids are saying, I'm struggling with this. I'm struggling with having a meaningful habit of prayer and a meaningful relationship with God. Need to teach them how to do that. So, will you carry that word home this morning, thinking about our kids? Kids need help learning to pray in a meaningful way. Now, the last one on the list you're not going to be surprised by. The last word I want you to carry away is the word friends. Because when the cards were turned in, that was sometimes the only word written on the card. I had asked the kids, if you don't make it to heaven, what will the reason be? And some of the kids wrote on the card, friends. I wasn't surprised by that, but it occurs to me that we should be. I mean, who is a friend? Somebody that is there for you and looks out for you and cares about you and acts in your best interest. And so a friend would be the reason you don't make it to heaven? How does that all go together? And yet we all understand that fundamentally there are two kinds of people we pull close in our life. We can pull close people that help us pull closer to God, create that momentum toward Him, and we know there are people who can do exactly the opposite. We can pull people close to us that tug at us and pull us away from God. It's not a new problem. If you go back to Proverbs, Solomon warns about that early. Proverbs chapter 1 in verse 9, "Hear, my son," he said, "your father's instruction. Do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent." And he goes on to talk about that. I won't go deeper into that context except to have you see. You got parents here who are pulling this kid in the right direction, but Solomon warns there are other voices out there that threaten to pull you away. Of all the things that were written on those index cards when the kids turned them in, the one that appeared more than all the other answers combined was this one. More than half of the kids in the room said, "If I don't make it to heaven, it will be because of my friends." For about a decade, I have been doing an informal study of people who leave us. Disciples who grow up among God's people, and then when they get out on their own and graduate high school or college, they leave for a while, and then at some point later in life, come back. I've been talking to those people, the comebackers, about their spiritual journey. And one of the questions I ask is about friends. The interesting thing is every single person I've talked to, without exception, says that the crowd had a significant impact on their decision to walk away from Jesus. It's a big deal, folks. It's having an enormous effect on our kids. More than half the kids in this little gathering said, "This is where I'm struggling. Or the crowd that's pulling me in the wrong direction." And so if we want our kids to go to heaven, we're going to have to stand shoulder to shoulder with them and help them engage this part of the battle and to connect with a good crowd. So let me begin by being crystal clear about something. Moms and dads don't just have the right to involve themselves in choices about the crowd. It is our responsibility to help our children make wise choices about the crowd. How do you do that, though, without being one of these helicopter parents that's just hovering over their children constantly? Let me say a couple of practical things about that. First of all, I think it's very important to start early. The very first time your little toddlers begin to interact with other kids, begin to talk about the crowd and the people they associate with and good influences and bad influences and good behavior and bad behavior and why it's important to draw close to you people who help you do what is right. As soon as they're able to begin trying to figure that out, let's be talking about that. And then number two, as your kids get older, get to know the crowd. Get to know the people that they're hanging out with. The way Heidi and I did that is we made our house the place to be. It requires a little investment. We bought a big TV and a ping pong table. Put the TV in a room right off the living room with glass doors. We didn't have to be in the room, but we could see what was going on. And we welcomed their friends at our house. When they would come, Heidi would feed them well, and we were happy they were there. And we didn't get all up in their business. We let them do their thing, but we paid attention to the crowd. We listened. And you learn things. You hear things. And as we began to get to know the crowd, we just sort of quietly nudged our kids toward good relationships. We made it convenient for them to be around good kids. I want to go to his house before they drove. Hey, we dropped everything. If that's a good kid, made sure they could go there. And inconvenient to go places we weren't comfortable with them going. Yeah, no, we're not going to do that this weekend. And we were candid with them about that. Yeah, you're not going to go over his house tonight because last time you were there, you guys watched a trashy movie. And that's not what you should have been doing. So we don't want you back over there. Or that young lady, yes, you can invite her over tonight. We enjoyed having her. She was very kind, very respectful. We like you running around with her. That's just fine. You can have her over. We had the conversations about that. And then sometimes you have to be the parent. Y'all know where this is going? Sometimes you got to be the parent and just cut off a relationship that is harmful to your kid. Well, it sounds harsh, doesn't it? And absolutely necessary. See, I've been on the other side of that. When I was about 14 years old, I was in love with a young lady who was not a good influence in my life. My mother, who was very perceptive, picked on that relatively quickly and patiently waited for me to figure it out. And when I didn't, she was a parent. And she came to me after an ugly incident and said, "This is over. You're not going to spend time with her anymore. This relationship is ending." And I was furious. And I said, "What right does she have to be telling me who I could spend time with?" I said that under my breath so she couldn't hear. I said it. I was mad. For a week, maybe two, she was cute. And I got over it. And your kids will too. But sometimes we got to be parents and protect our kids from the crowd. Because what the kids are saying is, "I may not make it to heaven because of the people who are around me." We need to help them with that. Heidi and I had a lot of desires for our children when they were growing up. And we actually got to see some of our wishes and dreams for them come true. We had some cool parenting moments. My boys played baseball for a decade. And at times, they were pretty good, and they would get picked for the all-star team, which meant this little baseball enclave where they played, right up there by the concession stand, there'd be this bulletin board, and their name would be on that list. That's a proud daddy moment when your son's name is listed on the list of all-star ball players. And then when my son was a senior in high school, he was a gifted musician, and his last year qualified for the All-State Band. And we got to go over to San Antonio for TMEA and watch him perform, and we picked up a program. We probably still have it tucked away some way where it listed our son's name, All-State trombone player. That's a proud parent moment. I think it meant more to us than him. Some of you have had kids that have graduated, and you go to that ceremony where they graduate high school, and you get that listing where your kid's name is written among the graduates. And then my oldest didn't just graduate from college where I got another one, but he went on to get a master's degree, and so I've got two or three of these programs with his name listed under his accomplishment. That's pretty cool stuff. And it's the trivial stuff of life. Because what really matters to my wife and I is that their names be on God's list. The one John described as the Lamb's Book of Life, that record kept in the mind of God of those who are saved. I will sacrifice the names on the list everywhere else just to have their names there. And if that's going to happen, brothers and sisters, we can't determine as moms and dads. We can't make the choice for them. Everyone decides whether their name will be written there or not for themselves. But along the way, and while they're growing up in our house especially, we can stand with them. And we can help them fight the battles that they say are putting their future on that list at risk. And to that, we need to be faithful. So will you carry away those words today? Lust, light, prayers, friends. Let's help them win the battle. So as I say that, I'm wondering where your name is written today. Here's the deal. It's not a mystery. We're not waiting for some board to vote and figure it out. We already kind of have a sense because of what God's book, whether or not our name is there or not. And if it's not, that's all that matters. And this time in our service is devoted for you to make a choice that will allow God to write your name there. If you need some help with that today, we desperately want to help you. And you can let your need be known by making your way down front while we stand, while we sing this song.